and will continue this great tradition that Sister Toni Morrison set for us all.
I want to thank you so much all for joining us. Sonia Sanchez, Angela Davis, Nikki Giovanni. Visit democracynow.org to watch the 2004 conversation with Toni Morrison and Cornel West, and so much more. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 17th and Sunday, August 18th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival features performances by Brian Smith, Dana Reason, Mel Brown and Gordon Lee, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 17th and Sunday, August 18th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the festival on Saturday from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello out there, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial unless your FM was made in America.
The time is 5:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next is the evening news. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Sweet Creek Foods, family-owned and operated in Elmira, Oregon, sourcing local, organic ingredients and supporting Pacific Northwest farmers and fishermen, offering organic products including salsas, pickles, jams, tomato, and enchilada sauces, and Oregon albacore tuna. Packaged in sustainable glass. More information, including product locator map, can be found online at sweetcreekfoods.com. This programming is also made possible by Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Open daily until 5 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. Coming up next is the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, a protester is suing the city, saying a Portland police flashbang grenade injured her.
As the heat rises, so does a death toll. Some say it's due to climate change and getting worse.
And our news poet weighs in on the devastating impact of gun violence.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 7th, 2019. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Annette Newell. A woman who suffered third-degree chemical burns from a Portland police grenade during a protest last year is now suing for $250,000. Michelle Fawcett says she still has an imprint on her left arm and continues to get medical treatment. She also experiences nightmares and the fear of sudden noises. She says, quote, "I never feel safe in my community." A flashbang grenade hit and injured her while she was protesting on August 4th last year. A flashbang grenade is a non-lethal explosive projectile that gives off a blast of noise and light. Now, it's meant to be fired overhead, but the officer in this case threw one into the crowd, hitting Fawcett. Portland police announced they would be suspending the flashbangs 2 days after the protests. Many others came forward claiming the police used excessive force during the demonstration. The city of Portland declined to comment on the lawsuit.
This week, Portland Police Chief Danielle Outlaw and Mayor Ted Wheeler warned demonstrators wishing to commit acts of violence or vandalism for protests planned on August 17th that they'll be met with the full force of the law. Wheeler said 18 times that he rejects violence as free speech perpetuated by demonstrators, regardless of the side. He claimed there will be a zero-tolerance approach, and if anyone breaks the law, there will be mass arrests. Activists from around the country are planning to meet Tom McCall Waterfront Park to hold an End Domestic Terrorism gathering on August 17th. The police say they will be prepared and well-resourced. Officials are considering a proposal that bans demonstrators from wearing masks.
People who have worked on the U.S.-Mexico border say President Trump created a migration crisis by stoking racial conflict. As Dan Hyman reports from El Paso, longtime observers of the border say the current migration crisis has been artificially manipulated by starving the migrant processing system of the resources that it needs.
Close observers of the El Paso border accuse the Trump administration of manipulating migrant policy to create a crisis with tragic results. Fernando Garcia with the Border Network for Human Rights has been close to the issues for 20 years. He says more people have sought asylum in past years, but Garcia says the difference now is that Trump is intentionally creating a racially charged conflict for political ends. He says if the administration were really worried about the buildup at the border, the obvious thing would have been to hire more asylum officers and immigration court judges to speed up deportation or asylum.
That didn't happen. The administration saw an opportunity to actually create what I believe this administration it is good at, to create chaos, to make it appear as a crisis.
Trump regularly describes the migrants as an invasion made up of criminals, with the migrants backing up in camps awaiting processing. The pictures reinforce that. But that view of America under siege also showed up in the writings of the shooter in this weekend's El Paso shooting. Federal immigration agencies have not replied to emailed questions by deadline. In the past, the Department of Homeland Security has blamed a lack of funds for the desperate and overcrowded conditions of migrants in detention. But Garcia points out that the White House sees no problem requesting funds for a border wall.
He got billions of dollars for infrastructure. So there's no way that they don't have money to feed children or to have more asylum officers.
Several studies have shown that immigrants actually create more jobs than they take, and other research has argued they can help save the Social Security and Medicare systems by paying in more than they take out. But Garcia says the emotional battle over migration could help determine the nation's future for decades, much as other migrants did at the beginning of the last century.
Ellis Island defined the character of the nation. But this is the question, what kind of nation we're going to have? The acceptance that America is not that white any longer, or we're going to have a border that incarcerates children, put immigrant families in concentration camps.
Dan Hyman reporting for the Public News Service.
After the events in Ohio, Texas, California, and Gilroy, many were left wondering if the event would happen here and how they could prevent it. The Portland Police Bureau has been training for years for similar events. The training division has been training officers since 2001 in shooter threat response, techniques, and tactics. The trainings are regularly updated. Over the past years, officers have educated the community on how to prepare for these events. Portland Police Bureau also has a youth services division that works with community partners to help the youth. They build relationships in the community to keep students and schools safe. If anyone has information about potential violence or concerns, you are encouraged to file a police report.
Some Walmart employees plan to walk out in protest of the retailer's gun sales policies today. The Washington Post reports hundreds of workers at Walmart e-commerce's office in Portland, California, and Brooklyn are planning to walk out. Their walkout comes after a gunman opened fire in an El Paso Walmart Saturday, killing at least 22 people and wounding dozens more. Now, just last week, a Walmart employee shot and killed two co-workers at a store in Mississippi. Organizers started a Change.org petition, calling on Walmart and its president and CEO, Doug McMillon, to stop the sale of all firearms and ammunition, ban the public open and concealed carry of weapons on company property in all stores, and cease wall-packed donations to NRA-backed politicians. But Walmart spokesperson Corey Lundberg provided this statement, quote, "There are many more constructive avenues for associates to offer feedback, such as email or leader conversations, and the vast majority of associates who want to share their views are taking advantage of those options."
Washington State projects have won more money to make their communities more livable for people as they age. As Eric Tegadoff reports, the famous Pike Market Food Bank was selected for the American Association of Retired Persons Community Challenge and will use its grant money to pay for more directional signage.
Carson City, Nevada, civil rights groups are suing the feds to stop a new policy of fast-tracking deportation for anyone who cannot prove they've been in the United States continuously for the past 2 years. The suit filed in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., claims the policy is an unconstitutional violation of the person's right to due process. Attorney Anand Balakrishnan with the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project said it's unfair to deport people without a meaningful hearing or time to consult a lawyer.
Essentially, what this does is strip non-citizens of their fundamental right to a fair hearing on the question as to whether they should be deported or not.
In the past, fast-track deportations only were applied to people caught near the border or who have been in the United States for a few weeks. But 2 weeks ago, the Trump administration expanded the policy to cover anyone in the country who is undocumented and can't show proof that they've lived in the United States for at least 2 years. The administration had said the change is needed to free up detention beds and reduce the backlog in the immigration courts. Undocumented people who have been in the United States for more than 2 years still can be deported, but they retain the right to get an attorney to fight the removal. Balakrishnan called the new rules a dramatic escalation in the current administration's attacks on immigrant communities.
In some ways, it is just another example of the administration's steady drumbeat of new and repressive laws towards both immigrants and their families. We're hopeful that the court will step in.
The new policy, which took effect July 23rd, could apply to hundreds of thousands of undocumented people. This week's lawsuit asked for an immediate injunction to stop the expansion of fast-track deportations and requests that the policy be reversed altogether. Details of the lawsuit are online at ACLU.org. For KBOO Evening News and the Public News Service, I'm Imara Moore.
In today's commentary, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says Trump is yelling fire.
Get our attention. While every day nearly 100 Americans are victims of gun violence, which is a symptom of the stark imbalance of wealth and power turning us against one another, fighting for the scraps thrown our way, while the power junkies in Washington know votes are like sugar pills, making us think we have a chance of getting better. Trump's yelling fire in the crowded theater of the internet, and his folks know by fire he means guns, so they're whipping them out. We cannot have a president who claims to not be responsible for what he says, a president whose narcissism leaves no room for love of country or the citizens he's supposed to be responsible for. The killings will continue. We shouldn't be distracted or afraid. Let's honor the dead by making sure a lot fewer die by guns. Let's honor the living by making sure a lot fewer die because they didn't have food, shelter, health care, justice, or love. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Washington State projects have won more money to make their communities more livable for people as they age. As Eric Tegadoff reports, the famous Pike Market Food Bank was selected for the American Association of Retired Persons Community Challenge and will use its grant money to pay for more directional signage.
From the AARP Community Challenge are small but can go a long way toward making cities more livable for people of all ages. In its third year, the program has selected four projects in Washington State. Amanda Frame, Community Outreach Director for AARP Washington, says the program is an opportunity to partner with local organizations, nonprofits, and municipal governments to work on AARP's Livable Communities Initiative. She says a lot of communities are in need of small funding boosts.
Receiving these applications just shows the need in our community and the services that are out there. And so this little grant that we give to these organizations to spark change within their community and creating a vibrant, accessible space for individuals of the community is exciting for us.
AARP received nearly 1,700 submissions, including 31 in Washington State. The organization is offering nearly $1.6 million in grants to 159 projects across the country. Among the winners in Washington is the Pike Place Market Food Bank, which is using grant funds to spruce up signage and make it easier for seniors and people with disabilities to access the site. The Pike Place Market Foundation also was selected and will be increasing its capacity with the grant. The organization Rebuilding Together Seattle is helping improve a senior center, and Frame describes the project from the remaining winner, Seattle-based Sound Generations.
The transportation system can be intimidating and hard to identify how to get from one point to the next. And so Sound Generations, in partnership with HopeLink, is really helping to increase independence and mobility, leading to enhanced social engagement.
Frame says all the grantees have begun work on their projects. They must be completed by November 4th. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the fight to keep the cleanup of the Willamette River going. At 6, it's Kitchen Table Conversations, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, we're going to see some increasing clouds, a low of 61 overnight, and tomorrow it'll be mostly cloudy, a high near 77. And today in history, in 1998, a massive truck bomb exploded outside the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya. Minutes later, another truck bomb detonated outside the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Those two attacks killed 224 people, including 12 Americans, and wounded more than 2,400. Our quote of the day is from Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison, who died this week. I always looked upon the acts of racist exclusion or insult as pitiable from the other person. I never absorbed that. I always thought that there was something deficient about such people.
Ohio lawmaker Candace Keller, who blamed mass shootings on drag queens, marijuana, and progressive policies, stuck by her comments as leaders of her own political party called her for her resignation. Ohio Republican Party Chair Jane Timken called on Keller to resign after the Republican politician pinned the shooting deaths of more than 30 people on a long list of reasons that left out white supremacy or access to firearms. Candace Keller's Facebook post was shockingly and utterly unjustifiable, said Timken. Our nation is reeling from these senseless acts of violence, and public servants should be working to bring our communities together, not promoting divisiveness. Keller told the Cincinnati Inquirer she plans to stay in office and continue a run for state senate. Establishment moderates have never been fans of mine because I ran against their endorsement and won, Keller said. As the only conservative in this race, I will be taking my Senate campaign to the voters to decide. Keller's brand of conservatism, it appears, includes pegging mass tragedy on the existence of LGBTQ people. She responded to the news this weekend of back-to-back shootings, including one in Dayton, Ohio, with a social media rant attempting to, quote, place the blame where it belongs. The breakdown of the traditional American family, thank you, transgender, homosexual marriage, and drag queen advocates, fatherlessness, a subject no one discusses or believes is relevant, the ignoring of violent video games, the relaxing of laws against criminals, open borders, the acceptance of recreational marijuana, failed school policies, hello parents who define misbehaving students, disrespect to law enforcement, thank you Obama, end quote. She wrote.
Today, Centoya Brown got out of prison after serving 15 years of a life sentence in Tennessee for killing a man when she was a teenage trafficking victim. Back in 2004, she was placed into adoption and ran away at the age of 16. She lived with a pimp who forced her into prostitution. When a real estate booker named Johnny Allen picked her up at a restaurant, they agreed to engage in sexual activity for $150. Brown said she thought Allen was reaching for a gun to kill her. She shot him in his sleep, took the money, and fled the scene. She was arrested and tried as an adult for murder and robbery. She wouldn't have been eligible for parole until 2055. The state's governor, Bill Haslam, bowed to pressure from lawmakers, celebrities, and other activists to grant her clemency. Brown said, quote, I look forward to using my experiences to help other women and girls suffering abuse and exploitation. Brown's story raised awareness about trafficked youth and criminal justice reform. While in prison, she earned her high school equivalency and started working on a bachelor's degree. She'll be meeting with counselors to create a re-entry plan that puts her into a transition center and helps Brown continue her studies.
Higher temperatures are signaling a growing health crisis for many communities across the West. As Mark Richardson reports, the numbers of heat-related deaths have grown in Arizona in tandem with more summer temperature extremes in the past decade.
Public health officials say the rising number of annual heat-related deaths in Arizona is approaching those from such disasters as floods, earthquakes, and hurricanes in other states. With high temperatures between 110 and 115 degrees on many summer days, fatalities and serious injuries, particularly among the vulnerable homeless, low-income, and senior populations, are hitting record levels across the state. Dr. Rebecca Sonnenschein with the Maricopa County Public Health Department, which encompasses the Metro Phoenix area, says the number of heat-related deaths has grown in the past decade.
We are seeing a remarkable number of individuals who are dying from heat-related causes this year. We're already at 12 confirmed, and we have 82 individuals under investigation for heat-related deaths. And at this time last year, we had 7 with 69 under investigations.
In Arizona, heat-related deaths grew from 200 in 2008 to almost 400 by 2018. Sonnenschein says those numbers may be low, as it can take weeks or months for coroners to determine if a person's death is attributable to heat. Average highs between June and September are around 106 degrees, but the number of extreme days, 110 or higher, has grown from just a few in 2008 to almost 30 last year. Weather officials issue extreme heat alerts when forecasts call for temps of 110 or higher. Sonnenschein says it's particularly dangerous on those days for some groups.
People who have chronic medical conditions, or especially seniors, we want to check on our neighbors, make sure that their air conditioning is functioning. Sadly, about a quarter of our heat-related deaths occur indoors, and that most often affects the elderly.
She adds that cities such as Phoenix and Tucson experience the so-called heat island effect.
The less green trees and grass and shade that you have in the area, the hotter the area will be and the more heat that is retained overnight. And it's that lack of cooling off during the nighttime that can really wear on people.
She adds climate change appears to be driving the record number of extreme heat days. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
A 13-year-old boy is recovering after doctors treated him in Washington State from his injuries after a man slammed him to the ground, supposedly because the boy didn't remove his hat for the national anthem in Montana. Police arrested Kurt James Brockway for suspicion of felony assault on a minor after the attack at the Mineral County Fair in Montana. Brockway's been on a registry of violent offenders since 2011. The young boy's injuries were so severe he was airlifted to a hospital in Spokane, Washington. A witness said, quote, "He was definitely bleeding out his ears. He was scared. He got out of the hospital today." Witnesses say they saw the attack happen feet away from them. One said, quote, "I looked over because I heard a pop, and the man had grabbed this little boy by the neck and slammed him to the ground."
Some groups are calling for fraud protections and a new e-payment system that the Federal Reserve is developing. As KBOO's Lily Cruz reports, online payments will become instantaneous once the new system goes online in 2024 or 2025.
Electronic payment system announced this week to be developed by the Federal Reserve. It now can take a day or two for funds from direct deposit and online bill payments to actually hit the account. The new system would make that process instantaneous, but Laurel Saunders, Associate Director of the National Consumer Law Center, said faster transactions could also benefit scammers. She urged the Fed to give e-payments some of the same protections people now have with their credit card purchases.
It's incredibly important for the banks that create accounts that allow people to receive payments to make sure that they're not receiving money for illegal purposes. So institutions that enable scammers to receive fraudulent payments need to be responsible for that and to compensate consumers who are defrauded.
The new system will be controlled by the Federal Reserve and will compete with another system being developed by a group of the biggest banks. Consumer groups want the Fed to develop important rules of the road so that financial institutions have an incentive to prevent fraud. Saunders said the new system will give lower-income families more immediate access to their funds and correct balances, which should result in fewer overdraft charges.
Real-time payments can help people understand better what money is in your account, because when you make a payment, if the money comes out immediately, you're less likely to get caught later with a payment coming out that you've forgotten about.
The Fed has released a set of questions about automatic payments, which will be open for public comment for the next 90 days. The new payment system is expected to be up and running in 5 or 6 years. The Fed's announcement is online here, and public comments can be made here. This is Lily Cruz reporting for KBOO News.
Drug overdose deaths in the U.S. have stopped rising for the first time in almost 3 decades. A doubling of prescriptions of the overdose-reversing drug naloxone in the last 2 years may be a factor. About 68,000 Americans died of overdoses last year. That's a drop from the more than 70,000 in 2017. Naloxone can reverse opioid overdoses, which account for more than two-thirds of drug deaths, restoring breathing and bringing the users back to consciousness. Multnomah County Health Services Syringe Exchange offers clients overdose rescue kits, and they include naloxone.
Operator data from New Mexico's Oil Conservation Division shows that by venting, the oil and gas industry increased by 56% in 2018. Now, as Roz Brown reports, people in that state are having a debate about the impact of oil and gas methane pollution.
New Mexico residents are having their say this month about state regulations on methane emissions from oil and gas operations. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham committed to implement rules that would lead the nation as part of her election campaign. Ahead of public hearings, the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association released its own methane mitigation roadmap, which it calls a solution-oriented approach. But environmental groups argue the industry's proposal would leave New Mexico with the weakest methane regulations in the country. Hillary Hull with the Environmental Defense Fund says regulations are working in other states.
There certainly will be industry pushback, but what we want to point to is places like Colorado, where a lot of these same operators are operating and are perfectly comfortable and are even finding the benefits of these methane regulations.
A public hearing is scheduled in Carlsbad today at 8:30 a.m. in the Skeen Whitlock Building. New Mexico frequently ranks at or near the bottom in state public education measures, with revenue for schools often tied to the boom and bust oil and gas industry. Farmington teacher Marianne Briety is convinced that lost revenue from methane emissions could improve that picture.
It's difficult to expand your economic base and to attract young people here and industry here if your education system is dead last in the country. Young families don't want to come. It's scary for them to raise their children in that climate.
The Environmental Defense Fund estimates the state could save more than $730 million in revenue over the next decade through comprehensive methane waste controls, compared to $180 million based on the industry's proposal. Briety believes the industry needs more accountability.
In our homes, we ask our kids to clean up after themselves. In our schools, we teach our kids to clean up after themselves. It just seems to me that it's not asking too much to ask industry to do the same in the state of New Mexico.
Studies estimate that New Mexico's methane emissions are more than 1 million tons a year. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
The U.S. stock market closed mixed today, with the S&P 500 and NASDAQ squeaking out gains and the Dow finishing in the red after a volatile trading day. The central banks of India, New Zealand, and Thailand all cut interest rates lower than economists had projected, deepening concern about the health of the global economy. China's yuan also fell below a 7-to-1 ratio with the U.S. dollar for the second time this week. When it fell on Monday, President Trump accused the Chinese government of currency manipulation. Now, that same day, U.S. stock markets posted their biggest losses of the year. Experts say China's currency moves are viewed as retaliation for Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods.
Puerto Rico will have its third governor in 2 weeks. The Puerto Rican Supreme Court reversed the swearing-in of Pedro Pierluisi, who was appointed less than a week ago by former Governor Ricardo Rosello. That came after mass protests forced Rosello to resign. The Supreme Court found that Pierluisi's last-minute appointment as Secretary of State, putting him in line to be governor, had not gotten approval from both chambers of the legislature, which is legally required. Next in line to be governor is Justice Secretary Wanda Vasquez, another Rosello ally. Many Puerto Ricans have said that they do not want Vasquez as governor, so they expect more protests.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. Here's Antonia Gonzalez.
Pamela Foster, the mother of a Navajo girl who went missing and was murdered, is encouraging tribes to establish and use emergency alerts. Her daughter, Ashlyn, Mike, and brother were abducted near Shiprock, New Mexico in 2016. It took hours for an emergency alert to be issued due to the lack of technology and a lack of tribal access to alert systems. Ashlyn, 11 years old, was later found murdered in a remote area on the Navajo Nation. Foster hopes no other families have to go through what her family did, and she's now an outspoken advocate.
The main issue was that there was not an Amber Alert established during the time of my children's abduction. And when I needed help, help was not available. And that was so heartbreaking. It was so devastating knowing that what life-saving method that you thought was always available wasn't.
Foster shared her story recently with attendees at the Amber Alert and Indian Country Symposium held at Isleta Pueblo in New Mexico.
When that tragedy hits you as a parent, you do all that you can do. And I've always heard along during my journey since Ashton's passing that if you want to know how powerful a person can be, you spend one day with a parent that has lost somebody in tragedy. They will show you the tenacity and the strength that they have, how they have to warrior up and fight for what they believe needs to happen.
Today, more than 100 tribes are working to implement the Amber Alert system. Legislation signed into law in 2018, named in memory of Ashlyn, provides federal funding and resources to help tribes with implementation. Jim Walters is with the Amber Alert training program and works with tribes to bridge gaps. He says there are many challenges facing Native nations, but says many tribal communities have found a way to make the alert system work.
As it seems like a huge task. It seems like it's daunting. We infrastructure, communications, staffing, and so forth. But the reality is all of those can be overcome. Communities across this country have done it. And what it takes is that flag bearer, right? Who's the person in that community that's going to stand up and make it happen?
Since Ashlyn's death, the Navajo Nation has implemented an Amber Alert program, which spans New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. Representatives from more than 22 tribes from 34 states attended the symposium. The Little River Band of Ottawa Indians in Michigan has been awarded a $700,000 grant to help build a new food distribution center. The program will increase the number of people served. Leaders told 9 and 10 News the program has seen a demand in recent years. The new center is expected to be finished by August 2020. The funding is from the Department of Housing and Urban Development to stimulate community development. The Fallon Paiute Shoshone Tribe in Nevada has been awarded more than $1 million to improve water treatment and fix aging infrastructure. The USDA grant to modernize the treatment facility is intended to help protect the environment and the health of tribal residents.